Now we have a drummer, huh? Am I on? Okay, sorry about our easel, but we'll... Technical difficulties. Anyway, turn to the book of Hebrews. We're going to continue our study of this book. And you need to understand that sometimes these... Most people think that this book was like a sermon, that there's exhortations or exposition of the Old Testament, and then there's exhortations. He talks about what that means to his readers. Most people think it was written to Jews that had become Christians, and they think it was written around 60 or 70 AD. So this is 30 or 40 years after Christ had been crucified. They had gone through a long period of time, what seemed to them a long period of time. Persecution had started. Most people feel that the tendency for, as things got bad, as persecution started, as suffering happened, you know, they started thinking, man, it was better back in Judaism. We need to go back to that. So the writer of Hebrews, and I really do think the main purpose of the book is in Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. And I'll keep repeating this because we got to remember, in order to, as we go through this book, and there's warnings in this book of that the writer says to his readers, don't go back. Don't go back. But he says in chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses, that was chapter 11 of all these people that lived by faith. Since we have this great cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and sin that so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who, for the joy set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and he sat down at the right hand of God. Run your race. Don't stop. Don't look around. Keep your eyes fixed on him. And then he says in verse 3, for consider him, Jesus, who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you may not grow weary and lose heart. They're essentially saying, you know, you wonder why suffering and why life has gotten so hard. Think about Jesus and what they did to him. Okay, and that's kind of what we're going to be looking at. We're going to turn to chapter 2, verses. We're going to look at verses 5 through the first 6 verses of chapter 3. So if we remember that as he's writing this, he's saying he wants to encourage them on what happened at the cross. Okay, and there's this... And as opposed to, when you think about suffering, you read these commentaries, most of the commentaries think these people were going through some very difficult times. They were either being persecuted for their faith, things weren't going well, and you have a tendency to just want to give up. I'm tired of the fight. And that's what the writer wants to encourage them to do. It's opposite of what Job's wife said to Job, curse God and die. You know, that's what you ought to do, Job. Just curse God and die. And Job's answer, I don't know if it's right after that. Should I accept good and not bad? You know, there's this whole idea that even in the midst of trouble, God can redeem that time. And as I thought through this, there's another thing as we're going through this section, and it talks about what Jesus has done. There's a now when he's talking to them and a not yet. There's a point that Jesus is in control and in charge and has set things right. But not everything, not yet. So there's a looking at now and then looking ahead to the future. And then as I thought through this, there's you know, in the Christian realm, there's like, well, this is how I pictured it in my mind. There's a balance to this. I'm going to have to draw with my left hand and write with my right. There's the one side of Christianity that talks about suffering and giving up things and I heard a guy on TV the other day, a vow of poverty. He was making fun of people that take a vow of poverty, you know, give up things. You know, what realm do you think he was in? You know, I mean, Christ made it so that you'd be healthy, wealthy, and wise your whole life. So he made fun of a vow of poverty. So there's a whole side of the world that says, or the Christian walk that says, oh, it's going to be tough, and buck up and be a man and take a vow of poverty. Paul was poor, so we're going to be poor. Then there's this other side that if you watch the TV, there's this health and wealth that if you're not wealthy, something's wrong. You know, something, what are you doing wrong? That God should be blessing you. If you, you know, I remember when in Chicago, when Diane's dad, he was the first one in the church that bought a Cadillac. And this was like a big deal. Nobody drives a Cadillac. You're wasting God's money. You should be living over here. You know, don't buy a Cadillac. And it just got silly. So there's, in most ideas, there's a happy medium. This is where we ought to be living. You know, in a balanced life that looks at life and says, is there going to be, you know, can wealthy people be Christians? Well, of course. If you're not, does that mean God's not blessing you? And whenever you see that, like on Holy Week in Jerusalem, there's a whole sect of people that go the, what's that called? The path that Jesus took. I forget. What is it called? Yeah, yeah. Where they're beating themselves and, you know, suffering over. The book of Hebrews, I think, puts this whole thing in balance. There's the now and anticipation of the what's to come. So let me just read verses 5, let's see, 5 through 8. And again, what I think, if I were to sum this section up, is that Jesus, the Son, came to restore believers' relationship with God. That's what he's going to... In the beginning, this is actually the first time Jesus' name is mentioned. Prior to this, he's called the Son. So this is where the Son takes on human flesh to redeem believers and put them back into a relationship with the living God. Okay, let me read from 5 to 8 of chapter 2. For he did not, he being God, did not subject angels... subject to angels the world to come concerning which we are speaking. But the one has testified somewhere saying, what is man that you remember him, or the son of man that you are concerned about him? You have made him for a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned him with the glory and honor and have appointed him over the works of your hands. You have put all things in subjection under his feet. For in subjecting all things to him, he left nothing that is not in subjection to him. But now we do not yet see all things subjected to him. But we do see him who has been made a little lower. Well, stop there. There's this sense now that the writer of Hebrews is saying, earlier, if you remember, he talked about there was God and then there's angels and that the Son is higher than the angels. And now he's going to bring, kind of talk about that again and say, and God made him, the Son, become a little lower than the angels for a little while so that he could redeem mankind. Okay. Oh, sorry. And that's what he's talking about. He says, who is man that you remember him? Why would you do this? You didn't redeem angels. Who is man that you even remember him, or the son of man that you are concerned about him? The point is, God's son became a man so that he might redeem, and he crowned him with glory and honor, and he appointed him over all the works of his hands. He gave him authority. It's through him that the world was made, and you have put all things in subjection under his feet. So there's this... That he became lower than the angels so that he could restore creation. And there's like, and I don't know if this there's the now. There's Jesus is now in, the whole world is in subjection to him. He has restored creation. He has brought man back into, given man the opportunity to be back in a relationship with him. But then there's the not yet. Can I write lefty? Not yet. There's the not yet. We don't see everything in subjection to him. I just was listening. I think it was Charles Stanley talking about, there's the prince of the power of the air. This Satan still has authority over this realm. Okay, that there's a sense that there's the now that God has redeemed, has sent his son, and we'll read in a minute, and there's going to be the not yet. So we're living in this kind of not yet right now. We're living in the time when we look around and we're like, well, there's suffering in the world. And a lot of the commentaries talk about this raises this one of the most difficult questions in apologetics. Why is there so much evil and we claim there's this good God? And really, Hebrews answers this question. There's the now and the not yet. Not all, verse 8, in subjecting all things to him, he left nothing that is not subjected to him. But now we do not yet see all things subjected to him. We still live on this earth. He didn't immediately redeem us and restore the earth and put us back in the garden. There's this sense we got to live in this fallen, broken, suffering world, and that we're not immune to that. We're not promised to be, you know, all healthy. I mean, when I hear those guys on TV and you think about how, when people leave those churches and think, I wasn't healed. What happened? Did I not have enough faith? I worked with a guy in Chicago. It's in one of my first jobs. And we went out. he took me to a Knights of Columbus or something. And we were having some drinks, and he started talking. And all of a sudden, he told me his story that his wife had been in a wheelchair for like 25 years. And every time a faith healer came to the church, came to the town, she made him take her. And every time they left, he was angrier and angrier and angrier because she left in a wheelchair. Because they said, you didn't have enough faith. The book of Hebrews is saying just the opposite of that. Life can get unbelievably difficult. But there's the sense that the Messiah restored your relationship with the living God, in spite of what suffering you may go through.